The Scouted podcast is brought to you with the support of our friends at Skill Corner, whose tracking data and performance analytics are used by many of the top clubs, leagues, and federations around the world. Covering a wide range of global competitions, Skill Corner's data helps customers to make faster, better informed decisions in recruitment, player development, and strategy. And we are now using it to support our own analysis of up and coming talent. For more information, visit skillcorner.com. Hello, welcome back to the Scouted podcast, powered by our data partners, Skill Corner. This week, I'm delighted to welcome a former EFL manager with significant coaching pedigree, having taken charge of over 1,000 matches, to the podcast. Really looking forward to getting into the nuts and bolts of what it takes to lead a team at the highest levels and learn more about the role he's undertaken in recent years, moving into the world of footballing consultancy, advising some of the biggest clubs in England. Paul Tisdale is a name many of you will be familiar with from his 12 years at Exeter City, in which time he led the Grecians to their highest ever finish in the Football League, helped produce the likes of Welsh international Ethan Ampadu, Aston Villa's Ollie Watkins, several other players, whilst winning two promotions, reaching four playoff finals, and achieving a net spend of zero on all player trading. First off, I'd like to thank Skill Corner for facilitating our introduction. But without further ado, Paul, welcome to the Scouted podcast. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, I mean, it's what these types of interviews and these types of podcast episodes, I like to start chronologically. But I think what would be quite beneficial is to just have a day in the life sort of explainer of what your current role is. Because obviously, as I mentioned in the introduction, a lot of people will be familiar with your time on the touchline. But since moving away from that, what is it in the world of consultancy that you're up to now?
Well, I've got my finger in a number of pies recently. I had my pandemic story. You know, I didn't think I wouldn't be a football manager in 2024. I had, you know, in my mind, I was going to do it forever. So I hadn't missed a Saturday in 22 years. And people talk about football merry-go-round. I stepped off it just as the pandemic hit. So I was well and truly off it. And it's amazing how in football things change rapidly. I had an opportunity to go to the States. I was actually in Manhattan in March 2020 to meet one or two people with a MLS club. The first case of COVID hit and I was rushed back out of the country before the gates closed, and found myself sort of sat on the bench really for quite a long time. And during that time I couldn't sit still. I set about number of things, and that's led to sort of me diversifying really. The decision not to go back into management hasn't actually been a decision. It's not been something I've sort of strategically planned. I found that jobs that I've wanted I haven't been able to get, and jobs that I don't want I've been offered. So, you know, it's not necessarily my choice. But what I did do is I got very busy and I started to create something out of the data work that I'd done over a long period of time. I tried to turn that into something tangible and more than just what I knew, into something that could be replicated and built. I also wrote a team development and leadership program. I thought that was going to take me two weeks, then 2 months, took me 2 years. So I'm currently into that sort of period now where I'm sort of doing a bit of a lot of things. I'm waiting for one thing really to take off. They're keeping me busy. I'm sort of self-employed. I have my own sort of small bit business and I'm really enjoying it. It's a challenge. I don't get the same Monday to Friday buzz that I did when I coached and led a team. But I have lots of other things that I'm enjoying. So my team development business, Tis Talks Team, I deliver to corporate business, essentially coaching coaches. So it's leadership techniques in big corporates through their management structure. So helping people manage communication and dealing with pressure maybe better than they they already are and help give them ways to improve that. I also work as what I call the football doctor. So I go into football clubs and I try to find performance improvement solutions using data, but also my experience as a coach. So I've got the experience on both sides of that fence, which is, I suppose, I'm beginning to realise quite unusual. So I can translate very well from the boardroom to the pitch and the pitch to the boardroom. And I also deliver CPD, so coach mentoring. So I've been doing that over a couple of years now, whether that's CPD in academies or whether that's individual coach mentoring at some big clubs for ownership. So yeah, I really have diversified. I'm enjoying it. And I'm very excited about what the next sort of period of my life might bring.
Do you find that there's a lot of translatable and transferable skills that you've taken from your life in coaching to the current work that you're doing now? Because I mean, it seems as though that, you know, there are lots of fingers in many pies there.
Yeah, the answer is almost everything is transferable. The product maybe on a Saturday afternoon is different. Mm-hmm. So if I'm working with a big retailer, the product they sell on a Saturday afternoon in the shops is a bit different than scoring goals, but it's the same process. I think when you start coaching, and I'd started in 1999, beg your pardon. The first couple of years, and I think it's pretty normal. You coach in the manner which you wanted to play, or the game you wanted to see when you were a player. So you do it very much from your own point of view. Then you get a light bulb moment when you suddenly realize it's about scoring more goals in your position, it's business and the practicalities of coaching and leading. And then you go through the process of turning that into leadership. And then you realize the longer you do it, and say go 20 years, you realize that it's about 98% leadership and 2% product, maybe even 99.1%. And actually, okay, assuming you have a pretty deep level of competency in tactics and in coaching capabilities, and you've got the wherewithal around you to make things happen, you know, essentially match day comes down to a game of rock, paper, scissors. The rest of it is man-to-man management, environment, clarity of purpose and selling the message to people daily, by the hour, to on the pitch, off the pitch. So all those things apply directly to business. I mean, the application, the analogy may be a football field, but when I do work with corporates, it might be a 2-minute conversation about what, you know, my world is football and this is how we do it. But then the rest of the day is a conceptual idea of how you can get the best out of your team and point them in the right direction.
You were talking there about how your coaching career began in 1999. And we'll get on to sort of that time when you were with Bath and the university. But of course, that a lot, like a lot of coaches and a lot of managers who've taken steps into the game, yours began, you know, in the playing form as well. And, you know, coming through at Southampton, just sort of looking in the preparation and show notes for this, I was sort of looking at the timings that you'd have been coming through and thought, oh, there's a little bit of crossover there, that, you know, there's a few names that cropped up in sort of lineups and team sheets and things like that. Kevin Phillips, for example, you know, obviously people like Alan Shearer were at Southampton in the early 90s as well. Matt Letizier, you know, what sort of grounding did that experience have for you, and what it's taught you for the rest of your career?
There are lessons to be learned in every experience, good and bad. I was at Southampton for 10 years, from the age of 13 to 24. The academy was incredibly strong, one of the lead academies at the time. I played in the youth team with Alan Shearer and Kevin Phillips, although Kevin Phillips played 2 years as a right back in the youth team, so try and work that one out. So you and Gareth Taylor played centre half, who went on to play centre forward as well. So, you know, it was a fantastic experience. Obviously, it was a high performing academy. The positive lessons were the discipline, and I don't mean discipline in terms of punishment discipline. I mean the discipline, the daily disciplines of basics of building a career, of communicating properly, learning how to function in a professional football environment, because the actual playing part, the performance part, is just one. Okay, again, I'd say it again. It's the product. It's the end. It's the manifestation. But you get onto that pitch by building trust in the people around you and being able to deliver for the business. And, you know, it was a fantastic environment in terms of those daily disciplines. And there were some fantastic coaches. Sadly, Chris Nicol, who's my first manager, the chap who signed me my first professional contract, he died this week. And there were some lovely people I met, some really good coaches. I had the pleasure of playing for Alan Ball, that sort of, he sort of brought me to life, really, as a sort of 21 year old, and gave my Premier League debut. And he taught me the bit that was, I look back on it now, the bit about, okay, discipline and tight structures is what every player needs in order to get to the next part, which is motivation to compete. And that's what brings the freedom and the creativity. You can't just say to players, do what you want. You know, and that is a complete and utter fallacy, that in order to get creativity from a team, you give them freedom. It couldn't be further from the truth. This is about making the structures so tight that the players don't even have to think about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Less is more. And then you inspire players to compete and not think about themselves, but think about the winning. That's when you get that extra step. And I had the pleasure of playing for Alan Ball. It was a great experience, and it gave me some real good disciplines to move forward. What you learn when you leave, you go to another environment, you're playing a different sport, which happened to me. You know, I left at 24. I think it was 14 clubs I could have signed for at 24 when I left. I chose the club, didn't suit me, the style didn't suit me. You soon realise you're playing a different sport. It's called football, but it's completely different. So the issue with being at a club a long time, especially a strong academy, is that you are taught and you are encouraged to play a certain way. It's very hard to break out of that into another environment. And I struggled with that.
Moving into sort of your coaching background then, and obviously you moved into the coaching world at a relatively young age compared to most. You know, there was obviously the decision to retire from the professional side of things at around, you know, 27, 28. And you began, I mean, at a university level, effectively, you know, where I'm sure you'll have seen a lot of ex-pros going at the top floor rather than, you know, the ground floor, like you may have done. But, you know, there you obviously, I mean, was it four promotions that you were able to achieve with Team Bath?
Yeah, I guess the irony was I never wanted to be a coach. I actually didn't want to stay in football. I was 10 years a player. I left Southampton, then Bristol City, then went to Helsinki, and then playing in Athens when I began to just struggle so much with my legs. It turned out it was a back problem and it was nerve pain. We didn't know it at the time. And I couldn't train every day. And at 26, I decided that I was slipping. My performance was slipping because I couldn't train all the time, and I could have come back to England and played at a decent level, but I wanted to be, you know, top of my game, not just hanging on to playing for the sake of it. But during that whole time, I never felt myself. You know, I wasn't, had no affinity to the environment. I couldn't affect it. It didn't affect me. It affected me, but not positively. What I now know is that I was the wrong personality in the sport. I say it pretty frequently that I was a very good cricketer as well. I played sort of similar level cricket than I did my football, and I should have been a cricketer. The person in the football dressing room, I was a complete mute. I didn't say a word for 10 years. I wasn't myself. In a cricket dressing room, I was the captain of every team I played in. So the idea that leopard doesn't change his spots, again, you know, it's about the environment that brings out the personality. I was the wrong personality, so I didn't really want to coach. It was only Alan Ball really that inspired me to want to improve performance in others, and that satisfaction of seeing others do well. So, you know, I stumbled into Bath University. It wasn't the football, it wasn't the coaching, it was the environment. And it was just Johnny on the spot, really. They were creating a new football programme. I went back to Bath where my family lived, and I literally stumbled into it. And it's the best thing ever happened to me, because I went to a wonderful environment, a real melting pot of ideas and innovation on the sporting side. I shared every day with 14 or 15 very, very proficient coaches in all a number of different sports. And it was a perfect apprenticeship in coaching. It was a perfect apprenticeship because there were no qualifications involved. There were no supporters, no stakeholders. The stakeholders were minimal. They were the players that I recruited and coached. We played in a league, and at the start, it wasn't about playing in a league. It was about giving young footballers a second chance, players that had left academies at 18, 19, and mixing education with training full time. That was the idea. But within a year, we realised that there was no economic leverage in it. So let's just see whether we can put a team together and start winning. And we did. And it turned out I could coach, and turned out I could win games. And I was there for 7 years. We had four promotions. We shot up the non-league pyramid. We'd gone all the way to the Football League, had the National League not constantly change the goalposts in terms of the constitution of the club at Bath University meant that it could never get there. But I had a wonderful time. The environment was great. It was an apprenticeship in non-football. So it was about leadership and man management. And I shared my ideas with athletics, rugby, hockey, netball. It was just fantastic. So I never actually wanted to leave. I enjoyed it so much. But there comes a time when you then have to sort of move on. And of course, it was during that time at Bath University I got into data, because I think it was 2003, I think it was, that Sports Co dropped a lab at Bath University with the idea, I guess, of selling the product and getting people to learn how to code it. And I was one of those three of us, a chap called Mike Baker, who's now with England for the FA, Laura Seth, has been with the FA a long time, and myself, and the three of us, I think, were the first people to learn how to code, match data. So it was a fantastic experience and set me up for what happened at Exeter afterwards.
I just want to go a little bit deeper into the data side of things, because obviously this is a podcast on scouting recruitment, but it's also very very data heavy. You know, I think the vast majority of people that listen to this will have an understanding of, you know, your certainly your basic data metrics, but also your advanced ones as well. And certainly the early 2000s, you know, using Sports Code and data at a non-league level, and that's really pioneering stuff. And you know, how much do you think that having that understanding helped you in terms of the winning side of things? Not the leadership aspects, not the soft skills and the intangibles, but the actual data side of things. Do you think that gave you those little marginal gains that were able to eke out the difference between yourself and your opponents?
Yeah, I think I was fascinated by it because I've always searched for the, you know, objective markers rather than subjective ones. And we live in a sport that's hugely subjective. And I probably struggled with that. My personality struggled with that as a player. So I was always on the lookout for objective markers, so that the fact that you could analyze a game and get data, which would give you answers, turn it into a science, was just manna from heaven for me. Turns out it didn't work. Absolutely didn't work for a coach. I mean, okay, I spent a couple of years doing it. You get these great, you know, feedback from games. It doesn't matter whether it's Premier League or Screwfix Premier, where we were playing at the time. It's still a feedback. It's still a synopsis of performance. So, but I describe it a bit like going to the doctor on a Monday. You limp in to the doctor, and he says, "Mr. Tisdale, I can confirm. Yes, you have got a bad left foot." Well, I know I've got a bad left foot. I want a diagnosis and a remedy. I know it's wrong, and that's how the data world seemed to feed back. It just told you what was wrong. There was no translation at all about how you could put it right. And I know it's got hugely better since then. But I think I packed up using it probably 2005, 2006 when I was going to Exeter. It was just a complete and utter waste of my time. You know, as a football coach, you need to win games. And if you've got a problem, you need to put it right in 2 weeks. You haven't got, I don't know, 2 years. So you're given 100 bits of information. Which one am I going to coach this week? The idea that a football coach has a joystick and literally controls everything that goes on the pitch. It's not American football. The game's completely fluid. There are moving parts everywhere. There's 22 players thinking something different. You can analyze 1,000 things, but as a coach, you need to focus on one or two or maybe three. So how do I know which one to focus on? And number one, it's a timeline. and it's done on stop start set piece scenarios, which doesn't, players don't work that way. So the players don't work that way, the data shouldn't work that way. So it's timeline, it's stop by stop, you know, throw in, then goes for a goal kick, then goes to something else, doesn't work. And it's, I believe it originated in rugby. So again, you've got this kind of like obvious game line in rugby where you fly like British Bulldogs, two teams facing up against each other, not the same in football. You know, the game line, the geography of a game, not necessarily, again, it does have a factor, but it's not like playing American football or rugby. So didn't work and I scrapped it and it was a complete waste of my time. But it wasn't a waste of my time because what it did, it told me how not to do it and how to build something different. And that's what I started to do in my first couple of years at Exeter.
Yeah, you're saying there your first couple of years at Exeter. I mentioned in the introduction that you spent 12 years at St. James's Park. And I mean, that's increasingly in this age of hire and fire, at certainly at EFL level, the longevity is the thing that stands out. And you know, that's without getting into the actual achievements of what you were able to manage there. You know, I mentioned the promotions, the playoff finals, the player development. I'd be very, very interested to begin with the player development from your time at Exeter as well, because obviously the standout names are the ones which have gone on to do, you know, fantastic things. And I know a lot of the time coaches will say, you know, you have to provide these individuals with the building blocks, but they always had that incredible talent, that drive, that discipline. And I've, a lot of the time, very, very keen to say that, you know, they only played a small part. But, you know, the likes of, you know, Ethan Ampadu, now playing for Leeds United and Wales, Ollie Watkins, England and Aston Villa, and, you know, Matt Grimes as well, you know, coming through and playing a real, really important role at various clubs in the EFL. You know, all three were instrumental. Rather, all three were at Exeter during a time when you were, you know, the manager there, you were instrumental. You know, I would be very, very interested to hear sort of the individual development stories that those three in particular had.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big topic. And first of all, there has to be an environment and a raison d'etre that says you want to develop your players. And this whole idea that you've got academy, you've got coaches of development, you've got managers, and they're very, very different components. And actually, unless they are aligned, it won't work no matter how good the player is, within reason. If you've got a Wayne Rooney cropping up every now and then, he's going to make it whatever environment he's in, probably. But, you know, these things should be aligned. And I was at a club that was small enough or compact enough in its dynamics that I was able to affect all areas and have a part in all areas. The only player that was an absolute definite that you would put your mortgage on was Ethan. He's the only one. I mean, so there were one or two players that I'd call accelerated development. And that is, it's just a tick box exercise. You've got to get these guys as much experience as quick as you possibly can. You know, with Ethan, that meant playing him as a 15-year-old. He was doing his GCSEs and he would have played 30 times just that season if he hadn't gone off to keep playing for Wales under 15s. He would have just kept on playing. And he was playing centre half in a team that was near the bottom of League Two. So that's quite, I mean, when people talk about blooding young players, you try picking a 15-year-old centre-back when you're near the bottom of the league table, because that's not about what the good things he does. It's about how few poor things he does. If you're picking someone on the wing, that's poles apart in terms of risk and reward. But picking a centre-back, a young lad, 15-year-old. But he was he was simply a tick-box exercise to get as much experience as quick as possible. And he went on to play for Chelsea under Conte as a 16-year-old. When we sold him to Chelsea, he jumped ahead of all the Chelsea academy players and went straight into the team and played a few games as a 16-year-old. So shows you the experience he had so quickly. Ollie Watkins was quite late. You know, he had the talent, he had the personality, he had the perfect everything apart from didn't understand his game and he didn't understand how that should fit in. He didn't see the game correctly. And it took us two or three years to sort of break that down. He was a player that needed to think about defensive duties. And with that, everything else flourished. The more you spoke about process with the football, the worse it got. So it was less is more for him. Matt Grimes was simply the start of an economic cycle. Very talented player. And we just dressed him up for Christmas. I mean, I just picked a team every week. I mean, we it was the first time at Exeter. We'd lit the economic cycle had collapsed. We were bottom of the pile for money. We had 14 players in the squad. I had to build an economic cycle, and it had to start with my best young talent, and it was Matt. I phoned around that summer, I forget what year it was, phoned around quite a few clubs and said, we've got this really good plan. I'm talking Premier League clubs, Championship clubs. Nobody wanted to pay more than a couple hundred thousand, if that, for a player. So I just decided we were going to build a team around him. He's a very lucky boy. I mean, circumstances, a manager that could do it and see it and could be trusted. I picked two senior midfield players at centre-back. So they just fed him the ball for 20 weeks, gave him every set piece. Spoke to the FA, said, I've got a very good player. Can you come and watch him? They didn't. They wouldn't come and watch him. So I took him for a trial at St. George's Park when the under-20s were training. I had to take him to St. George's Park on a trial. A year later, he's captain of the England under-20 side. So he was definitely good enough, but they weren't going to come and watch him in League Two. And dressed him up for Christmas, and we got sort of best part of £2 million for him. And he's worth every penny. Swansea have had some very, very good value out of him. So, I crafted that scenario. He was a very lucky boy to have that opportunity, and he's gone to be a terrific player and deserves it. But I think when you look at player development, it's not just the best ones, the ones in that top 5% bracket. I think you are judged on, if you've got a group of 10 players, it's easy to spot the best one. It's easy to spot the one that's not going to make it. The eight in the middle are the difficult. And if you can get careers and if you can optimise that 80%, you know what you're doing. That's where you get judged. And we had a target. I'd set a target that every year we'd get one academy player to become a first team player. I don't mean an appearance in the Johnson Paints Trophy in the 94th minute when you're 3-0 down. I mean 100 matches for the club, maybe 200. That's a player who makes it. Because you might not sell that player before, you know, because you've probably got a gap until he's 21 before you can sell him, 20, 21. But if he goes and plays 200 games for the first team, that's value. And we did that every year of our academy. We had one or two or more that came through and created that kind of value. So that's development. And you do that with the environment, the coaches, coaching the coaches, how to develop, and continuity. You know, I think, I look back through those years at Exeter, the academy was small and tight. We were frugal with our spending because that's the kind of club we were, but we had continuity. And I didn't exchange know-how for young coaches that just had a new way of playing and wanted to come in and coach for 6 months and then jump on their coaching journey. That's not development. That's for the coaches. That's one of the biggest problems with the academy. It's for the coaches, not the players. The coaches just to develop and move on. So I resisted that, and we stuck with the same coaches. They may not have the latest qualification, but they had the know-how and the wherewithal to be trusted by the parents and the players, and there was continuity of feedback, clarity of direction, and that gives the players the chance to be optimized. You change the coaches every year, you get a coach that's got just a slightly better qualification, got a bit better way of coaching a 4-3-3. He's gone in 6 months to another club. I didn't want that Exeter. I wanted players to benefit, not coaches.
It sounds a lot like you know, your sphere of influence at Exeter was considerable. And I know you've kind of touched on that. And that, you know, whenever you speak to coaches, adding value is something which is of great importance to them, certainly when it comes to player development. But the idea of coaching coaches as well is something which is, I don't know, maybe certainly at the level that gets covered day to day, it's more of a novel concept. And you know, would you say that the academy and the way that you were able to build that trust with, you know, a core of coaches who you knew you could rely on, was that something that, you know, aside from the winning and aside from the, you know, finishing the highest in the football league that Exeter had ever gone, would you say that is something that, like a passion project that you felt most proud of or most pleased that you were able to develop that framework?
Yes, I mean, 12 years is a long time, and it wasn't, I had no options to leave. I had plenty, but I was engaged and motivated. It was personal for me. It wasn't about the coaching necessarily. It wasn't about my career as a coach, which is the conventional way of doing it. You get a promotion, so your stock is high, move on before the club gets rid of you. Well, I trusted the club wouldn't. They trusted me. So there was trust both ways. So for me, my motivation was to take Exeter as high as I possibly could. And when people would say to me, you lack ambition, I'd say it's far from it. It's the opposite. I'm trying to get Exeter from National League into the Championship. How do you call that lacking in ambition? The only way to do it was to do it, you know, financially, because with any plan, it starts with the business plan before you then talk about winning games and developing people. So you have to understand what's possible, the financial structure. So the only way to do that was to create it at Exeter. We had no investment. We had, well, we had 100,000 from the fans every year. That's what we started with. We had no overdraft for the bank, legacy of the CVA in early 2000s. So it was a very good discipline. What we created, we could spend, and that was it. And we had to strike even. So with the more players that we could sell, the better. So you wouldn't get a better scenario for development than that discipline and that pressure to play players in order to create assets to sell them. You do build your reputation, though, on your authenticity. And if you can win games and 4 player finals, 2 promotions, those sort of things help. But the idea that you can create a development program just like that, I mean, I hear clubs say, well, we're going for youth next year. I mean, goodness sake, it took 10 years to create that at Exeter, that level of credibility, because it comes down to the manager talking on the TV at 5 past 5 on a Saturday or on the radio. And parents of 12-year-old boys and girls are listening to these things, their local club. Is my son going to sign for that club? And it's organic. It's over a long period of time. The culture is created that we trust this club. And if my son spends 5, 6, 7, 8 years there, it's going to be worth it. And that's how you turn. And you don't do that in a year. It took 10 years to create that level of trust and authenticity. So the passion was, for me, I suppose my first couple of years, I was thinking about me as a coach, not losing 2 games in a row. That was my only compass from the day I started at Exeter. I knew the average tenure of a manager was 11 months, I think, then, back in 2006. So don't lose 2 games in a row, because 1 game becomes 2 games, becomes 3 games. So I actually went 127 games before I lost 2 games back to back. That was my only compass. Not I want to coach I've got a magic key with a 4-3-3. Well, do me a favor. You know, it's the bag and the players thinking the same thing. Those things develop over time. It's about making sure you do that, lots and lots and lots of sensible decisions, not looking for anything Hollywood. But then when you start winning and you start seeing the joy and the satisfaction that gives you, you then get attached. And I did. And then it's about creating something. My ambition was much more than me, much more than winning a game. It was about creating something at the club. So that's why I chose to stay. And largely because of the compass, which was we have to produce our own players. And then that's a very simple compass, because when it comes to the crunch, you're under pressure. I'm picking Ethan Ampadu as a 15-year-old because I know that we need to sell him, or it's good for him. It's good for the next player to see that how early he plays and how quickly he accelerates and what his future looks like. It just promotes the next one. Mm-hmm. But to do that when you're second bottom of the Football League with a 15-year-old at centre back, that is the acid test. And that's where we were. I don't know whether it's still there at the club. I don't know. You'll have to ask them. But for my time, Steve Perryman, who was alongside me, is my partner in that for 12 years. We knew exactly. We had clarity under moments of pressure when we had to make our decisions. We had clarity, and that was developing young players. And actually, I have to say, it's developing all players. We had players that we signed, 27-year-olds that were round peg for a round hole to play a certain position. They developed. We signed players who were 34, 35, 36 to turn them into coaching. Mm-hmm. They developed. So, and the coaches off the field. So it was an environment conducive for development in all areas.
Yeah, I suppose it comes back to that whole adding value element to it. And what I want to know about Exeter and your time there is that, you know, you were talking about how the data and the application of data at your time at Bath and how it, you know, it wasn't of incredible use, but then obviously data kind of took off, didn't it? I mean, the exponential rise in terms of the clubs that were giving a lot more, I don't know, giving a lot more credence to advanced metrics and actually, you know, higher, you know, developing analytics departments rather than, you know, just thinking, okay, well, we don't need this. It's about winning at 3 o'clock on a Saturday. How did you sort of use data in this sort of developing players mindset at Exeter? Because I'm sure, again, it's the feedback that, yes, we know this player is good because I can see it with my own eyes. The data is simply reinforcing that. But was there a way in which you were able to, I don't know, work out individual plans for certain players that you thought, okay, maybe they've got potential, but they're not kind of hitting the benchmarks that we expect them to of their sort of physical profile or their technical profile based on these numbers? You know, what was the use of data like at Exeter for you?
Okay, so I mean, if you get the right model, it works in every area of the club. Recruitment, match preparation, optimizing young talent, it works for everything because it's synced, and that's the challenge. If we go through the journey of recruitment of players and development of players, it was once upon a time, it was tacit. You know, we'd do what we've always done and we'll get what we've always got. And this is how I remember it. So this is how we'll do it. Then there was metrics, and it tends to be technical and physical. So I can remember as a player in the sort of 90s, learning about this sort of very two-dimensional profiling. But I knew I couldn't turn any of that into coaching, how did it all go together and move together? Because it's about team game, you know, and you've got to get individuals independent within that. They've got to play as a team. So that was my journey then at Exeter, really. I decided that the work I'd done with the sports code system, I couldn't use. It gave me great Monday morning feedback, but I couldn't use it. So I arrived at Exeter. We tried to recruit players. We realised that no one was going to drive from London past about 8-10 clubs to come to Exeter. We're paying less than anyone else. It's a long drive. You know, if we could see a right back playing in the league in London, he wasn't going to come to Exeter. So I had to find a different way of having your traditional scout didn't work for me. I had scouts into my second year at Exeter, and in my last 10 years, I had no scouts. I had 10 years with no scouts. Because what I did is I created my own system. One, I have a recruitment filter, just cut into the chase. So let's not waste our time with all these players. Let's just work out the ones who might actually join us. So that was a good filter. That cut down 1,000 players into about 100. But then it was about how do I actually make this work with my style as a coach? So it's got to match the way my team plays or how I feel and visualize the game being played, how I talk the game. So I spent about, I think, 5 or 6 years watching every single game at Exeter to develop my system. And I was actively using it, and I was doing my best to, I mean, we were winning games, right? So I wasn't doing too much wrong. But it took me about 5 or 6 years to crack it. I watched every single game that we played. I often watched it in full speed to quarter speed. So it took a pretty long time. But I wanted to see every bit of movement. For me, it's about connection and the collaboration of a group of players, how they move together, how they think. Because if they think correctly, they'll act correctly. So how do I get them to think correctly? I don't watch individual players during a game. And the number of times someone will say, we got there, number 8 was great today. I haven't got a clue. I'm looking at space the whole time. I'm looking at space. How do you utilize space? How do you manipulate space? How do you stop space? How do you create space? Because it's about the connectivity of that group of players. So but what I discovered watching these games was that there weren't that many principles to the coaching. So you think that, okay, you start coaching in the screw fix, that the Premier League's going to be, okay, the quality of the product, but the principles of the way the players should think and how they ought to think collectively, it's no different. So I mean, I've been working with a Premier League club or two this year. It's the same as I was doing in the screw fix. That it doesn't make any difference. You know, when you lose the ball, you know, you get caught on a counter-attack. If you're the coach, you want to say, chaps, run back as quick as you can, wouldn't you please? That doesn't change whatever level you're at. So if you strip the game down into these principles, you can actually think about, well, this is actually how the players need to think. Therefore, that's how the coach needs to coach. Therefore, that's what the data needs to give me. So it was a way of creating a third dimension. When I first started using it, and it was done by my eye, and I trained the analyst, and the first analyst that helped me with it was Dave Lee, who I had work experience at a university, and he's now GM of New York City. So it was a pretty good grounding for him. He spent 2 years with me, and we trial and errored all sorts of things and came up with all kinds of concepts that didn't work. And, he's gone on to have a fantastic career now in the MLS. And it's just it's a conceptual melting pot of ideas that can help you coach. We then, I suppose, started using those metrics like a filter, really. So for our own players, for recruitment of other players, head to head against the opponent, etc. Even optimizing talent coming through the academy. That's where Ollie Watkins was a real piece of engineering, because within these metrics we worked out there were certain areas he was very poor, in other areas he was fantastic in. So it was about making him think and align to the areas he's good in. So what you're trying to do as a coach always is amplify strengths, reduce weaknesses, make players feel good about themselves, and create an environment where they all can be optimized. And some moving parts. So when people say to me, what's your favorite style of play, I'm like, I can play any style of play. How good are the players? What are their strengths? The concept that at most football clubs, the manager can have an idea, he can go and see the owner, this is the way I play. And then within 6 weeks, the whole club can change to fit to the manager. I mean, it's absolute nonsense. The way of doing it is I've been to interviews with, and probably lost a couple of jobs at sort of championship, premiership level, where they said to me, what style of football do you play? I said, whatever suits the players. And like, it's too flippant, and I shouldn't. I was very confident at the time with what I could do. It doesn't really necessarily present well, but that's how it was. That's the reality. How do you get the best out of the players overnight? And it probably takes 18 months to change the way a team plays. If you want to play more football without losing games, it's going to take a two or three transfer windows. So it takes a while, but you've got to get the best out of the players. So every style is significant, every style of play. And if you're a coach, you need to know every style of play. The way that I collect my data is the principles of play with the ball and without the ball, using off the ball metrics, which is what my system has been built on. So 10 years ago, when I used to say I collect data, off the ball data, people would look at me like, that's too simple. It's not. And I think now it's becoming more and more recognized. How am I supposed to coach attacking football if I don't understand how to coach a defensive team? And when I start mentoring or working with coaches, I always ask, it's a pretty crude question, but I'll always ask, who controls the movement of the ball? The team with the ball or without the ball? Well, the obvious answer is the team with the ball, but conceptually it's the team without the ball, because where they stand dictates where the other team will pass the ball. If you all stand on the left side of the field, they'll pass it the other side. So it's a very brief way of explaining the team without the ball has a huge impact on where the ball moves. So collect the data, you then sync it for all your needs as a football club. And that's a lot of the stuff I'm now doing as a football consultant, where I'm trying to audit performance. I'm trying to identify areas that can be improved quickly, those that need work over time. And I put it into a filter system, which pops up some very interesting answers that clubs just don't see. It's like a health check. It's a health check of coaching. And it's amazing how that then can knock on to recruitment of players, styles, personality. And this is the third dimension, the personality of the coach, which affects the personality of the team, and what the limits are based on your own stadium, the atmosphere you play in, because all these things play a part. It's a fascinating topic, and one that I've now, well, I used it for 10 years, didn't do me too bad. I think for three seasons I had live algorithm that I used. I had trained two analyst to watch every game live. That gave me live feedback to make substitutions, which is a little bit unconventional. I have to say, even with 600-700 games experience, it was still telling me things I didn't feel or see. It was just tells you everything you need to know. I did that. I think I had a 50% win ratio over 150 games using two live analysts. So that's been my journey with it. And I would fully advocate coaches understanding data, because it really gives you an extra arm when it comes to your job.
Yeah, I mean that's really fascinating. To get actually into the real nitty gritty of what it takes, and there's just so many moving parts. You know, I feel sometimes that the way that coaching and the way that football is sometimes described and it's distilled is so rudimentary. And I always feel as though if I was in a position where I was a coach, or I was somebody who, you know, was working in an analysis field, I'd feel as though the way that football is often described is a world apart. It's a completely different sport, as you say, to what actually does happen behind closed doors and all that sort of thing. And I suppose there are elements that, you know, you probably didn't want lots of people to know that you were, you know, doing this stuff with two live analysts and that these were the processes that you were undertaking at that time, because
no, the players didn't even know. I wouldn't tell the players.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
The last thing they need to know is, you know, Tiz has got all these files and algorithms. I mean, that's, you know, we lose.
Don't overload them. Yeah.
For me, I'm done. Yeah. I mean, so that's for the coaches to know. That's for me. You know, the art of this is to have something so formatted and structured that you can cover everything and you can turn it to science. But then as it gets closer and closer to performance, it turns into something that's natural. Mm. So, you know, you have to train like your life depends on it and play like you don't care. And that's how the players, that's the concept for the player. Now, the more you tell a player, the worse it possibly can get, because you turn into process, you turn into formula. So, you don't want that. Maybe set pieces, yes, but the best possible instruction you can give any player, if you want to guarantee that he's going to get a 7 out of 10 performance, and there's nothing going to get in the way, is you mark that player there. You don't let him move, and I'm judging you solely on marking him, as long as you are physically capable of it. That's the simplest instruction for any player. The more you talk about the ball and the options and everything else, it gets harder, because you dissipate the focus. So what the art of this is, the coach, is to create something so structured that you can analyse and create strategy and everything else. And when it comes to the player's just out there thinking, I'm beating my opponent. And when the ball's crossed, I've got to be in there. Or whatever it is that player's got to think about. So it's less is more. And that's been the journey, actually, you know, from 1999 through to the last couple of years, is realizing that in order to achieve less is more, you've got to put a hell of a lot of work in. And that's what I meant at the start of the conversation, where I said Saturdays now is rock, paper, scissors. But the amount of work that goes into that is huge.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. What I'd like to get onto just before we finish is your current role in consultancy. And, you know, you touched on the fact that you've obviously been working with, you know, some high profile clubs this season. I'm curious to know, like, if you're talking about how you can sort of how you can make clubs more efficient in certain decisions, you know, I imagine that there will be clashes of, we don't necessarily need this external advice from certain people within clubs. You know, how do you find that your consultancy services and your expertise is welcomed or received by clubs and you know, when you're pitching yourself to them?
Depends who's inviting you in. I mean, you know, so some of it's been for the ownership, some it's been for the manager himself. Within all these processes, the sensitivity of the initial period is vital. So I suppose I've walked the walk, I've been a player, I've coached 1,000 times. They appreciate that I understand the environment. So anybody in that football club, in that building, to some extent know that I have some credibility to and affinity to the environment that I'm in. But I have to go very slow because you've got to get buy-in and you've got to work out very quickly who the decision makers are, and you've got to tread very slowly. Now, you know, essentially what you're doing is you are doing some kind of performance audit in order to find a common thread that everyone understands. So there's no point making it too complex at the start. So, you know, just picking up on some scatter graphs, frequency graphs of performance. I'm talking about now the actual matches. So you pick up on something that kind of goes without saying. It's not foolproof. It's not, you know, it's not like you've just found the magic key. But you're picking on something that everyone can suddenly concentrate on. Then you build from there. So, and what you're trying to do is trying to find an awareness of there being an opportunity for improvement, and then you get an acceptance that it can be done, and then you build a pathway towards that, and then you've got a brief, whether that's for 2 weeks, 2 months, whatever it is. And you are, I suppose, filtering data in order to turn it into coaching language. That's what I've done.
Yeah.
So I can, you know, I've spoken to ownership groups about this, and I think they struggle themselves, and suddenly they realize that I can translate for them, but they find it very difficult to understand that I go to a football club and within half an hour, first team manager can be happy that I'm there discussing it, because I've suddenly translated something that is now palatable for everybody. And I'm not telling anybody how they should play or who they should pick. I'm just making obvious conclusions. So, for example, if you're signing a player and you're spending a lot of money on him, and you are just looking at his outcomes, his current outcomes, how many, let's go with an attacking player, how many goals or assists or whatever, how many passes he makes, it's very hard to align that to the style and the format that your team plays in, because you've got two different managers, yep, maybe a different league, different competition, different atmosphere, different the pitch is even a different size, you know, the systems are different, the players they're playing, how can you, you're not judging apples to apples. So what I will do is I will look at my filter system and I will say, well, all these good aspects happen in these files. Other ones, and the other files are obsolete or they don't exist for this player. And then you look at your own team and say, well, you know, we've got a need for this, or this is exactly how we play. So I'm trying to align styles. So you're spending money and you're not saying we need a striker who scored 20 goals, because that striker might have scored 20 goals with crosses with his head. And you don't cross the ball. So it's a complete and utter misalignment. So I try to map, and it's, you know, it's been a hell of a lot of work. It's been 20 years work. And then I present it on a one pager. It looks too simple. And that's been our problem. It looks too simple. But it's just cutting to the chase and making sure that we're judging apples with apples.
Yeah, no, it makes complete sense. I mean, how many times do you see, you know, and we will stick with the striker example, you know, he scores 20 goals in a division with a certain manager. And, you know, you were talking about, oh, what's X style of play earlier? And then they come somewhere else, come somewhere different. And it's like, oh, well, maybe they haven't settled and maybe they're not getting in this. But it is, you know, apples with apples is a good analogy, because you can't bring a player into a completely different environment. And, you know, when you're saying that you're not watching individual players on a match day, you're watching the space. So something is as small as, I mean, to me anyway, something as small as the size of the pitch isn't going to make that much difference. But for example, to someone like you who has that experience, it is going to make a huge difference when it comes to making informed recruitment decisions. Is that where you find with, you know, speaking to ownership groups, do you find that they come to you for more recruitment based work, or is it more sort of match analysis work?
I tell you where it starts: troubleshooting. There's a need that they've got a need, mm-hmm, and they can't quite work out. It's a development need or a match performance need, and they can't. It's not tangible. There's too many opinions, and it's just too much noise. So it's normally a troubleshooting exercise that quickly turns into something that's formatted and can be developed. Because in a football club, Monday to Friday, I mean, it's a very transitory environment. Things move very quickly. 1 week's never the same as the next. It's not like a normal job where you can cruise through, you know, a number of weeks just doing the job and you can spot. This is just fast moving. It's raw. It's like a roller coaster. So it's very hard for people to concentrate on long term. So the alchemy is being able to affect someone for Saturday, work on something that's creating a habit over, you know, a training cycle, a couple of months or whatever, with a player, so you can improve something. And at the same time, you're activating change over a, you know, a window to window period. So if you can, as a management team, if you can do all three at the same time, you've got alchemy. It's a lot of managers will do win at all costs this Saturday, and you might get some results, but you're not backing up any kind of development for the future. Or you get a manager, the perfect manager for the long term, and he's lost 3 or 4 games and he's gone. I mean, it makes no sense. So what clubs tend to do is they tend to detach now the manager, make him a head coach, and they have all these people around having different roles, and they solve one problem, i.e. the manager's not responsible for everything, but they create 10 times more because alignment is harder. You're the most important aspect in any football club is relationships, whether that's the manager to the board, the manager to the supporters, the supporters to the players with each other, relationships everywhere. And the most important job a manager can create is good relationships. So he can communicate good and bad information under pressure, good times, bad times. The best managers are the best relationship builders. They do it in different ways. Some are collaborative, some rule by pressure and fear, but it's creating strong relationships so that you can deliver information and keep everyone aligned. So the more people you have in different roles, the harder that challenge is. So that's why we love the game, because if it was just about you pay the most money, everybody, and it literally is a pecking order of, and I know the very, very top clubs are always going to be in a top echelon, but it's not that simple. You know, that's why clubs can outperform. That's why you can get the stories of Luton and all the teams that just outperform. It's fantastic because they suddenly get alignment and they get connectivity and they get a shared sense of clarity on what they're trying to do on and off the pitch. So data comes into that by helping with the product. It also comes into how you deliver, even down to language. If you understand how the game works, then with coaching, if I'm mentoring a group of coaches, more about the language, getting alignment on language than it is about whether they know how to coach a 4-3-3. I mean, honestly, if someone comes to me and says, I want to be a coach and I've discovered the best way, the best formation, I'm like, well, that's number 99 on the list, mate. Number one is tolerance. Number two is patience, et cetera, et cetera. Then selling ideas. And then you name it, we'll get down to that. What tactics you're going to coach at number 99, because without the first bit, you're not even going to start the game. So I think this is all about how do you use data in all sorts of different aspects of your job as a leader, as a manager, as a coach, even down to language. It's important that all the coaches say the same things at the same time in certain emotional influences during a game.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds all encompassing. You know, winning hearts and minds is the most important thing. It's something that we hear so often, but having it sort of spelled out is something different altogether. Paul, I just want to give the opportunity for anyone who has listened to this, you know, whether they are working in clubs or working in the world of football, how they can get in touch with you and get in contact, because I'm sure there'll be a lot of people who are very interested in hearing more on what you have to say, and in particular with them in relation to their clubs.
Yeah, well, it's in my interest to connect and build my network now. The chance of me going back in to be a football manager, it's not dead. It'll come down to opportunity, but you know, the way I see this is I'm building a network now to build this new sort of phase of my career. So I will have a website very soon. I've got a new website coming up, paultisdale.com. If anybody wants to get in touch, then paultisdale@icloud.com is pretty easy to remember. So unless you spell my name wrong, paultisdale@icloud.com. So yeah, I'm pretty busy and I'm energized about what happens next.
Excellent stuff. Well, I think I can certainly vouch for that, given our conversation over the past hour or so. Paul, thank you very much for joining me on the Scouted podcast. It's been a fascinating conversation. I've certainly learned a lot. I feel like I've had a whistle stop to a seminar style in the world of coaching and application of data and all that sort of thing. But I hope everybody listening or anybody listening, you gained something from that. We'll be back shortly with some other interesting interviews with equally intriguing guests. But thank you, Paul, and thank you again to our partners, Skill Corner, for facilitating the introduction. If you are somebody from a football club looking to get that extra edge, do check out what Skill Corner are offering with their off-ball data. It is truly fascinating. We're doing a lot of work on the Scouted website currently. Lots of pieces using that data, and throws up some really interesting little nuggets of information. But I've been Joe Donoghue. This is the Scouted podcast. Stay safe, take care, and bye for now. The Scouted podcast is brought to you with the support of our friends at Skill Corner, whose tracking data and performance analytics are used by many of the top clubs, leagues, and federations around the world. Covering a wide range of global competitions, Skill Corner's data helps customers to make faster, better informed decisions in recruitment, player development, and strategy. And we are now using it to support our own analysis of up-and-coming talent. For more information, visit skillcorner.com.